Hello and welcome to the latest podcast from the Glasgow Centre for Population Health, supporting new approaches to improve health and tackle inequality. In this podcast, Karina Hawkes, Professor of Food Policy and Director of the Centre for Food Policy at City University London, explores what we need to do differently to tackle obesity equitably. This was recorded in front of a live audience in Glasgow as part of the GCPH seminar series on the 28th of May 2019.
Thanks very much for that generous introduction. It's really, really nice to be in, indeed, sunny Glasgow. Really lovely to be here. Thanks for welcoming me. This morning I arrived and spent the morning going around a few projects and getting a glimpse of what's happening in Glasgow. And it's always really inspirational for me and always a great learning experience to visit on the ground projects and programmes. So thanks very much, Jill, and others who are here who helped with that. So what do we need to do differently to tackle obesity equitably? This is a question that's been preoccupying me ever since I started working in the field of diet-related ill health 20 years ago now. And when we look at the data, I have to say it gives one pause for reflection. I was invited to give a talk in Australia a couple of years ago, and I gave two talks on why we were failing. And I was in a particularly reflective mode at that point. But seriously, I think it's important to constantly be learning and reflecting. I'm much more positive now than I was then. I think I was just in a bit of a bad frame of mind. But I guess... when the problem is still as big as it was then, even worse, one should and must reflect on what needs to be done differently. So this is a great opportunity to try and think through what I think needs to be done differently, building on the experience that I've had internationally. So I still work internationally. The experience that of the UK, but most recently the experience I've had as Vice Chair of the London Child Obesity Task Force. The London Child Obesity Task Force has written a plan. It hasn't been released yet. It should be released in July if all goes to plan. It's a plan of actions for others to take. We have no power. We have no money. We are not a delivery mechanism. We're an independent group that has made observations about what's happened in London and what we think are some of the actions we think can be transformative in taking considerable action already taking place in London to move forward. So I will be dwelling on some of that as well as I talk. So I wanted to start with some data about where we are now, and many of you will be familiar with some of this data. It's really to make the point that the issue of equity is just so critical, and that's where we're really not making the difference. This is data from the United States showing a declining prevalence of obesity among the Women and Infants Young Child Nutrition Programme, commonly known as the WIC programme. And I use this slide to indicate that we are beginning to see progress in different parts of the world. And there are 35 jurisdictions in the United States that have reported declining obesity prevalence among children. So we're not at a situation where absolutely everywhere in the world obesity prevalence is going up. So this is some of the good news. And I noticed in Scotland that this also appears to be the case. I'm no expert on the Scottish data. I'm sure there were experts on the Scottish data in the room here. But it did seem to me that there was a small decline here in Scotland too. And if you look at England, if you look at reception years, so that's age 4 to 5, we call it reception in England, 4 to 5, you're seeing a slight and small decline among high prevalence groups at that age. But you are seeing a quite stable amounts. What this is designed to show is how it varies between local authorities. So in some local authorities, it's stable. In some, it's going down from a higher level. And then when we get to age 10 to 11, it's either stable or it's going up. So there are these different trends, and it's the same in the United States, and it's the same throughout many countries in Europe, that there are these area differences. But what's significant is that the odds of being in one of these higher categories is, of course, greater in children who are affected by deprivation. And that's what this graph shows also. Forgive me for saying that's a complicated and difficult to read graph, but it makes an important point. If you look on the right-hand side, the least deprived, this is year six boys, you will see declines in overweight and obesity prevalence. If you go to the next one along, quintile four, then you'll see it's kind of going up a bit. And then further you track to the left, it goes up. So in other words, among the most deprived communities, children in England, overweight and obesity is going up. If you look at the least deprived, the wealthiest, it's going down. What does that mean? It means the equality gap is getting bigger, because the wealthier people are changing behaviours, are being affected by policies, whatever the reasons are, but that's not the case for the most deprived. Therefore, the equality gap is getting bigger. And if we look throughout Europe, you see a similar pattern, not everywhere. This pattern isn't happening in all countries. This graph goes on a lot longer down to the bottom if you read the World Health Organization document from which it comes. But in most of the countries, if you look at the pale blue there on the right, that was the difference between the top and bottom in 2007. In 2014, the difference between the top and bottom had become the solid turquoise block. In other words, it had increased. And the dynamics between different countries are different. Belgium is an example, which is at the top, is an example of where the changes have been driven by declines in more affluent people, not increases in the most deprived. So it shows that we are seeing different trends, but this increase in the equality, inequalities. This is an example from France to show the situation among adults. And what this shows in the pale green, on the right, it's 1997. So in the grey, it's 1997. And then the dark block is 2006. And then on the right, the paler green is 2012. So what you can see there is that percentage of the population who experience obesity is going up in all of those categories. But the rate of increase is much lower among the higher income groups and much, much higher in the lowest income groups. Therefore, the inequality gap is growing. And that also appears to be, from what I understand, in the case in Scotland. This is women and this is children. I can't explain that sudden dip in children in 2016, and won't seek to. There may be some people in the room who understand that, but what this seems to show very clearly is this deprivation gap. And it's the same in low and middle income countries. It's a bit of a different situation. In most low and middle income countries, poorer countries around the world, obesity is associated with wealth and higher education. It's a very complex picture. For the Global Nutrition Report, we did a whole load of analysis on it a couple of years ago. Very complex picture. But even though on average, people who obesity prevalence is higher in wealthier, more educated people, the rate of increase in overweight and obesity is highest in the lowest wealth quintile or the lowest education group in a substantial number of countries. And that's what we call the nutrition transition, the epidemiological transition, where obesity is one of those things that drifts down from the higher income groups to the lower income groups. So eventually, unless we act, all countries will be like Scotland and like England, in the sense that obesity will be concentrated in the lowest income groups. So I wanted to highlight the role of diets in this. I'm not going to talk about physical activity. For the record, I think physical activity is immensely, immensely important. I'm not one of those people who doesn't think it's important. My expertise is on food and diet, so that's what I'm going to talk about. So on diets, let's start with the international data that the state of the global diet is pretty diabolical. It really, really is. This, again, a bit of a complex picture to understand. This is from the Global Nutrition Report from 2018, which is the last report that I led on. And if you look at this data here, I'm not sure if this, no, it isn't that, but that's fine, don't worry. If you look at minimum dietary diversity and the highest quintile, which is in turquoise. So what this shows is that highest quintile and lowest quintile are remarkably similar. So minimal dietary diversity is an international measure of the quality of diet. And to save you from reading the graph, it shows that 74.6% of children, this is low and middle income countries, do not have sufficient dietary diversity for a healthy diet. And it's 75% in the lowest one quintile and 56% in the highest income quintile. So what this shows is that diets are appallingly bad among the youngest of children internationally, and that they are poor in rich groups and in poor groups, but worse among lower income groups. So this is showing something similar for diets. I won't for adults. I won't dwell on that one. And when you look at dietary differences within countries, again, this is low and middle income countries, that lower socioeconomic groups eat less fruit, vegetables, fish and fibre than people of higher socioeconomic status. But higher socioeconomic groups, again, low and middle income countries, eat more fat, salt and processed foods. But then what happens is that the amount of processed foods, sugary foods in particular, then drifts down to the lower income groups. So there are certain countries in which lower income groups, like Mexico, for example, consume more processed foods and sugary foods and so on. So again, it's the dietary shift that then shifts down to the situation that you have in Scotland. This is from a Food Standards Scotland document, that the least deprived eat the least fibre and fruit and vegetables, which is the case all over the world for lower income groups, but also more sugary drinks. And less sugar and sugary drinks, but basically more processed foods and less of the healthy foods. So what happens is that the less healthy foods is the case for poorer people everywhere. And then what happens with the transition is that lower income groups eat more less high quality processed foods. So what I'm trying to illustrate there is that what's happening in Scotland is part of a global situation. It is not unique to Scotland with the equality gap, but that putting it in the broader global context, that we must remember that this is a global problem in which diets are shifting, were always the poorest among poorer people, but in a way have gotten even worse with the high fat, high sugar, salt foods coming in, which drift down from the high income groups to the lower income groups. So that is not a great situation. Even though we have declines in obesity and some improvements in diets, it's not a great situation from the perspective of where we are headed. So where do we want to get to? I really think that we need to be aspirational in saying that is the current situation, it's not a great situation, but where do we need to get to? What does good actually look like? And I've been given quite a lot of thought to this. Well, we have the Eat Well plate, we have food-based dietary guidelines. And ideally, what we want to see is all people eating diets that promote their health. So we want the social norm to be healthy diets. I think it's very hard to disagree with that, though some perhaps might, but all people are eating diets that promote their health. That is the norm. And that is broadly put, one can argue with the Eat Well Guide, but broadly aligned with the Eat Well Guide. So the vision that I have used to be, and I'll put this up now, right at the bottom. I come from a background of thinking about food environments, healthy food environments. And about, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, we started to talk about this idea that food environments available, affordable and acceptable, that food should be available, affordable and acceptable. Great thing to say, still stand behind that. I absolutely agree that healthy food environments need to make food affordable and acceptable, and was writing documents a long time ago saying that. However, I've moved on since then, and I think we need to take a much more people-centred vision. That was, in a sense, it needs to be available to people, affordable to people, and acceptable and appealing to people. But I think we need to go be even more people-centred than that and think about people in their entirety. So my own thinking has moved on. And I think that in order to achieve a situation where all people are eating diets, we need to achieve 7 things. And this is coming from a people's perspective. First is that people need to know what a healthy diet is. I don't think that's necessary for children, necessarily when they're young, but I certainly think it's the case for most of the population. And I think most of the population do know what a healthy diet is. People need to have the skills and literacy to prepare and buy a healthy diet. No point in knowing what a healthy diet is unless you actually have the ability to know how to buy it, to know how to prepare it. No point in having those skills and education and knowledge if you can't afford it. So you have to be able to afford a healthy diet. Even if you can afford the healthy diet and you have the skills to prepare a lovely, delicious meal and you know what it is, you've got to have the assets and capacity. If you have a job, that means that you're working 2 jobs. That takes you out of the house at 5 o'clock in the morning and you don't get back until very, very late at night. If you don't have a kitchen to prepare food in, those are just 2 examples of why people don't have the assets and capacity to eat and prepare a healthy diet for them or their children. And then even if you could do that, if you can't access it, in other words, if it's not in your neighbourhood, even if you have the assets and capacity, it's not going to do you much good. So you need to be able to access it physically. The 6th factor is around social relationships. So this is a new thing for me. Not won't be for some of you. But it's relatively recently that I have understood the weight of evidence about the social aspects of food. That we need to have social relationships that support a healthy diet too. That could be peer-to-peer relationships at school. If your friend is going out at lunchtime to get some really bad food for lunch, you don't want to be left out. If you're socially isolated, a community garden can help with that social isolation. There are lots and lots of these social relationships which I have come to realise are really critically important in this area. I've always understood it about food in general, but now I've realised how important it is to healthy eating as well. And finally, if we're really going to make this sustainable, people have to prefer a healthy diet. They have to actually want to eat a healthy diet, to enjoy a healthy diet. So when you are trying to grab those minutes in the evening when they've had a bit of a bad day and you want to maybe just try and have that conversation with your daughter or son or husband or somebody in your life, and when you're sitting down trying to sit somewhere in the house, the flat, whatever that you have, you don't say, let's get out the packet of biscuits and have a natter. You say, let's have something healthy and have a natter. Because at this point, I wouldn't blame anybody for saying, let's get the packet of biscuits out and have a takeaway and have a natter. That would be logical. How can we shift it so people are actually in, have all of those 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 things that enables them to say, we're going to really enjoy eating something healthy, even if it's not explicitly so. So that is a people-centred vision. And boy, is that aspirational, because that is incredibly far from where we are now. It's very, very far. But if we are serious about addressing this problem, I really believe that we have to achieve all of those things. And if we're going to achieve all of those things, it's not about, it's a people-centered vision, but it's a people-centered system. It's not about saying we have to go to those individuals and say, you need to want to have a healthy diet, or here's a bit more money to afford a healthy food. It's not about targeting individuals, though some of it is about individuals. It's about changing the system that underpins those seven aspects of those individuals' lives. We need to have a whole system that is enabling people to achieve this vision. And people aren't separate from it. So in the early days, you got these kind of models where you said personal factors, system factors, upstream, downstream. It's all part of the same system. We should see it as a system, not as personal and system or upstream and downstream. It's all part of the same interacting system. And that's what this figure attempts to depict in a very simplified way. The details don't matter. The idea is that you've got people at the centre and there are aspects of the system that link around them. So that's the vision. That, first of all, the bad bit, the data, vision, aspiration. What is the current situation that can get us to this vision? There's plenty of policy out there. I hear sometimes people say, oh, there's nothing happening. There is tons happening. These are just a few policy proposals and actions that are being taken. You're probably familiar with all of these in Scotland. There's probably not a single one of these that isn't being taken in Scotland by somebody somewhere. So lots of really good proposals and lots of action. Internationally, several years ago, I established something called the Nourishing Framework when I was head of policy and public affairs at World Cancer Research Fund International. And what we did was to bring together policy actions from all over the world. My colleagues there now maintain this database, and I was always extremely strict. It could only be implemented action, not action written on paper. It now has 530 implemented policies from over 130 countries around the world. So there are actions that are taking place. So what is the problem? Why are we still so far away from that vision? Why does the data still look like it does, particularly the growth in inequality? So here's my critique. The actions aren't bold enough, and by bold, I mean big enough and scaled up. There's not enough of meeting people where they are. There's not enough connection in people's lives, and there's not enough coherence with the whole system. I'll go through and explain each of those. First of all, not bold enough. And I really should have spelt this out and meant kind of not bold and big enough. But this is the bold bit, which is around the actions which are being implemented. I know the politics of this approach, of this field pretty well, and I can understand why people don't go out with extremely bold actions to begin with. There's a lot of opposition, there's a lot of politics around this. But since we are in a situation where countries like Scotland have already implemented various actions, and many other countries, it's a question of looking what has come before and saying, how do we build on that? So this example is of the restriction on television advertising in the UK. And we know that the restriction that came into place in 2007 led to less children seeing adverts for high-fat, sugar-salt foods in children's programming. But it didn't need them to lead to see less advertising because the advertising migrated onto more adult-oriented programming. So that's an example of a... And by the way, the UK action that was implemented in 2007 was, until very, very recently, the most comprehensive approach taken anywhere in the world, with Chile taking the lead, or will do at least in a year or so's time. But it's an example of how, if we take very contained proportionate actions, which is the words that the government uses, always proportionate, again, for extremely understandable reasons, it may be proportionate in terms of the action, but may actually not be effective enough because it's not got enough coverage. And we see the same with scaling up actions, that there's lots and lots of small actions being taken as well. This is population level, but a lot of smaller projects that are going on that are taking place in different parts. And we see this particularly in large cities. You probably see this in Glasgow, but in London, a lot of different actions being taken in schools, for example, in different boroughs. We have 33 local authorities in London alone. And yet they're very good in some areas, much weaker in others. There's not very much cross-learning going on between them. So we're not getting that scaling up of some really strong actions. What do I mean by not enough of meeting people where they are? This was a big... I wrote a paper for The Lancet that came out in 2015 where I went and did a lot of reviewing of systematic reviews. Systematic reviews are great things, they're important things, they enable knowledge to move forward. But they're also flawed in the sense that they try and come up with one answer. Is this promising or is it not promising? Is this effective or is it not effective? I was reading between the lines of a lot of existing systematic reviews, as long as going reading a lot of original scientific papers. And my conclusion from that process was that we were making a mistake in not understanding how different policies are received and by different populations. So this is an example of menu labelling. A lot of analysis in the United States on menu labelling. And there was a paper that says menu labelling is effective. And this is a menu out-of-home menu labelling. Okay, it's saying effective. And then other studies were saying it's not effective. So what's going on here? So I went to look at the footnotes and all the little small writings in the paper. And the one that said it was effective was that it reduced calorie intake purchased by higher income, more educated, higher calorie consuming patrons of coffee chain, read Starbucks, who previously underestimated the amount of calories in food items. So it was a very small decline when it averaged out. So basically, that's people in Manhattan going to the gym, going to Starbucks afterwards, and seeing how much are in those muffins, which is colossal, and thinking, oh my goodness, I'm not going to have a muffin, and eating less calories. Now, that's great. It's a really important thing to inform people. Don't get me wrong. I think it's a really important action and should have been taken. But just imagine if you're down there, if those of you who know the United States, down there on the East Coast, in Baltimore and Philadelphia, with desperately poor parts of New York City too, but this study was done on frequent fast food consumers, which are going to be a lower income, much lower income population. They went into the fast food chain, menu labels there, didn't even notice them. It's not what they were looking for. It wasn't their intention. They dared to grab some food, not to worry about how many calories are in things. Didn't even notice them. So that's an example about how the same action can be received very differently by different populations. And I hope it makes it clear why I think these actions are going to be more effective for higher income people than people in more deprived circumstances. So in other words, when we're designing actions, we need to think, so what are people's lives like? And how might that affect their response to a particular action? Third, which is related, is that the actions aren't connected enough in people's lives. So in the London Childhood Obesity Task Force, we are taking a child-centred approach, and it's aligned with the approach that I take in my Centre for Food Policy, of a people-centred approach to food policy. So if we stand, okay, let's put ourselves, try and put ourselves and look at the evidence and engage, indeed, with people living their lives. Just say that you have done a wonderful thing for your child that day, which is to give them a really healthy breakfast like this. So you give them a really healthy breakfast, and you know what a healthy breakfast is, and you give your child a healthy breakfast. You don't know that that bread is incredibly high in salt. So that's maybe not so much related to obesity, but certainly related to healthy eating, is an example about you might have knowledge, but you might not have perfect knowledge if you haven't been fully informed. And then your child goes to school and she gets a school lunch, a bit like some people do in Brazil. This is a Brazilian school lunch. I don't know whether it would go down well here, but it's a healthy school lunch. Needs to be culturally appropriate, of course. So school lunch is sorted. Delicious and nutritious. And then that child goes out of the school, and this is in Peru. These are all international examples. This is in Peru. Child goes out of school, there's junk food all around the school. Could be a fast food chain, could be something else. Then walks past a fast food chain and the healthy meal is way more expensive than the less healthy meal. Then parent goes into a store and sees this breakfast cereal, cartoons on it, kid pesters, it's not shown here, but there's a big sign at the top says whole grains. And the mum, being fully informed, says whole grains are great, I'm going to get this. Then the kid goes home and there's a load of advertising on television. So in other words, there are some bits of their of intervention in their life, in this case knowledge in a school meal, which are brilliant. But then there's other bits that act to undermine those actions. So they're not connecting. So there's bits in people's lives, but it's not coherent across those lives. It's not consistent in their lives. Now, you won't be able to read this, but this is some work that we did in London Child Obesity Task Force. When we went to speak with people who live in situations of deprivation in London and said, tell me about your day. This wasn't a piece of research, by the way. It was anecdotal, done through connections through the task force. But we did go and speak to kids and to parents to get a sense in London that could inform our work about their day. And the first thing that this child told us and the parents told us is that mum and dad are up at 6 o'clock, out the door at 6:30 to go and work. He was a construction worker, I think, in this case, and she had two jobs. So not much time to prepare a healthy breakfast then. Take her to grandma's, who fortunately lives quite close by, but grandma is sick. So grandma can't really prepare the healthy breakfast either. Child sits in front of the TV, then drives to school because grandma is too sick to walk her to school, so doesn't get the physical activity. At school, there's a school meal, healthy school meal, but she doesn't much like it, and her peer group don't much like it either. And there's a tuck shop at the end of the day. Going out into the high street, mum picks her up from school, in this instance, takes her shopping. Mum has already done a lot of going through all the discount coupons to try and get the cheapest things at the supermarkets. And those discount coupons are on the least healthy items. So that's what she buys. And because she's so busy looking after the house as well as with all her jobs, she buys freezer foods. These are all incredibly logical things to do. They're sensible, intelligent things to do. And then there's a whole bunch of stuff about physical activity there as well. So this is just trying to kind of understand these actions and the challenges that we have when we think this is a great idea, but when you actually look at the reality of people's lives, how challenging that can be. So my argument, I guess, is that unless we get all of those aspects of people's lives sorted out, having enough money, having the skills, the knowledge, the access, the relationships, all of that, we're not going to tackle this problem from an equity perspective. And because not all of these aspects are satisfied, we're limiting the impact of the actions we are currently taking. So this, to me, is an equity issue, but it's also an efficiency issue. That if we're going to take an action, let's try and maximise its ability to be effective. And at this point, we're not. With all the best will in the world, with all the fantastic action that is happening. So limiting impact on inequality. Final point is about not coherent enough with the system. Now, I could say a tremendous amount about this. I also work a lot on food systems. I'm going to limit my points to a couple of key issues. I want to give the example of school food standards. And the conversations I've had today, I think many of you will be very familiar with what I'm about to say. School food standards, incredibly important. One of the earliest, if you look globally, if you go to the Nourishing Framework and look globally at what's happening around the world, the largest number of actions globally is in schools, school food standards. It's the most common action that's being taken to improve school food environments. So you've got a school food standards, great, it's a good standard. It's been devised by scientists, it's been put out there, there's all the guidance documents, everything has been produced. Now, this is a photo from the days of when Jamie Oliver was talking about school meals. I don't know whether you remember this, but there were these pictures, I think it was in Yorkshire, of mums pushing food through to their kids through the gates. And of course, all the cynics said, oh, you know, fail Jamie Oliver, oh, you know, all this rubbish, they don't like the food, and so on. And it was more complicated than that. But the reality was that the kids did feel sort of imposed on. Parents felt that they hadn't been asked. And when you read them, they just said, just nobody asked us. And we care about our kids, and we care about our kids having enough food. And to me, health means my kid having enough food. Again, a totally logical, sensible, caring and loving approach. And they were worried when their kids suddenly got this food they weren't used to and weren't eating it. That's being called a good parent. Not a bad parent. It's been called a good parent. It shows there was a lack of engagement with the parents in the community. So you need to engage with parents. Parents are part of the system. Now, this is very common, probably the case in Scotland too. Crowded dining halls. Nobody has enough time to eat, particularly in secondary schools. A very rushed, unpleasant school dining environment. There may be some exceptions in Scotland. I suspect there are certainly in England and other parts of the world as well. But with the best will in the world and the best school food standards in the world, if people find that they're not enjoying the social experience of eating, this is the social relationships bit, it's a disincentive. So that shows that part of the system is the way that food is consumed, not just the nutritional standards. Another part of the system are the people who serve food, who are involved in producing food. They're also an important part of the system. This is a headline from last year. School catering staff feel excluded, undervalued and poorly trained. Again, this is a newspaper. This is from a report. I can't speak to it specifically. It's meant to indicate the fact that these staff are part of the system, and if they are not trained and understand the importance of the school food standards, they are much less likely to deliver them or even to usurp them. And then, of course, there's money. If you don't have money to pay for the healthier food, it's impossible as a school, then you can't put it on the table. And maybe that even means you won't put any food on the table if you're running out of money. So money is part of the system, and school leadership is part of the system. So that's what I mean by understanding this broader system of delivery as being so important, that it isn't just the action, it's everything that goes around it that is absolutely essential in order to have that system delivered, that action delivered. And we see that implementation. So we see lots and lots of policy proposals, and often they are poorly implemented or weakly implemented. And you feel, you know, the will isn't really behind it. But often this is because of these implementation blockages in the system. And that very much includes economic blockages, which I'm going to come on to later. So I would argue that we have a current situation which, even though there's lots and lots of strengths about it, has limited impact and limited implementation. So what do we need to do differently? What I think we need to do differently is be really, really strategic in the way that we design policy. And for those of you who are involved in designing policy, what I'm about to say won't be new to you necessarily. In many senses, it's just common sense and pragmatic. How do we prioritise the policies that we are going to deliver? Because even though I've given a picture of saying, well, we need to do all of these different things, at the end of the day, we need to prioritise. You can't do everything. So I think the first aspect of that is to take this people-centred view and to say, OK, what are the real inconsistencies in people's lives? And 2 years ago, I would have said, let's look at food environments and let's look at the inconsistency in food environments. So, for example, is it the food around schools? Is that what we need to transform from junk food into more nutritious food? Is that an area? So, okay, if we're going to focus on that area, that's changing the food environment. That's an inconsistency and a gap. But now I would say, 2 years on, that we need to look even more broadly than that. In this situation, this person knows what a healthy diet is. They have a healthy school meal available. And if the actions around schools work, they also have access to a healthy diet. And we know from the evidence that if people are surrounded by healthy food, the nutritious food, when they are growing up, they are more likely to prefer it. So there are some really good possibilities about these actions here. But let's look at the person as a whole. They might not have the skills and literacy to prepare and buy it. They might not be able to afford it. They might not have the assets and capacity. And they might not have those social relationships. What are we doing when we implement these actions to add in this piece of it? This is what I mean by starting with people and understanding the entirety of the constraints of their lives. So every action actually requires a suite of actions. And this is an example from the early years, a slide I put together when I was trying to think, okay, what would you do from an early years perspective? Acting in the early years is absolutely fundamental. I haven't stressed that today, but in my narrative, but I would say that absolutely early years is essential. And what I've tried to put together here is the idea that you need to have maternity leave. You also need to have healthy conversation trainings for healthcare workers. You need to have restrictions on and really, really tight oversight of the quality of commercial baby food. But you also need lactation rooms at work. You need to have mandatory standards for preschool food, but you also need peer-to-peer support. You need all of that. You need vouchers to help with affordability, and so all of that put together. But as I said, to prioritise, what do you prioritise? And that's where this idea of systems thinking comes in. The idea of thinking what action is going to be like have a domino effect on all of those other things. What's the action that can actually have transformative potential? So that when you take that action, suddenly something else happens too. So for example, this morning, I was with Anna here in the front, looking at the healthy retail standard. And we were talking, and I learned that the fact that there's a standard means that the vending machine operators, I think I've got this right, are negotiating with their suppliers. So that's not something that was mandated or they were told to do that, but they have to do that in order to meet the healthy retail standard in the hospital. So that's an example about how another action results from the particular action that you're taking. So in other words, what are these actions that can have these ripple effects? So in the London Child Obesity Task Force, we've said there's one action that we've put as number one, and as I said, we haven't released this, and that is that people need to have more money. So we're particularly talked about living wage, it's not ideal, all the rest of it, but that actually is a transformative action, just giving people, making sure that people have more money and are properly fairly paid, given that most poor people are in work. Not all of them, but most. So that's what we would say is a transformative action. But it's not the only action, because we know from international experience and other experience that if it's just about money and not changing food environments and not changing other things, it's not the only thing that's needed. But just to take the example of early years, Is the transformative action going to be that peer-to-peer support that is going to get women, men, parents, caregivers, grandparents at that complementary feeding stage, for example, talking in a way which could have a kind of ripple effect throughout communities? And then demanding change and saying, I want commercial baby food to be better. I want to have lactation rooms. I want to learn. Is it going to come from there? Or is it going to come from something like a healthy food voucher? In England, they're called Healthy Start vouchers, and we have the Alexander Rose vouchers as well. Is it going to be something like that, or a new model of that, which can actually say, OK, I've got this money, and I can only spend it on fruits and vegetables for my child. And is that going to... And now I've actually got the money that I've wanted and needed. Is that going to be transformative in terms of making changes in the local economy? These are judgments that we have to make, but it's important to think about what transformative potential these actions can have. In the London Child Obesity Task Force, we've identified 20 actions in 10 areas, which don't, when you read them on their own, they don't sound like a big deal. But nevertheless, on the basis of our analysis, we believe that they have transformative potential. We may be wrong. We're just going on the best that we can. So that's about prioritising policies, understanding it from people's perspectives to identify what the options are, and then saying the priority will be the one with the transformative potential. The second bit of strategic is about policy design, human-centric design. So in the London Child Obesity Task Force, we're going to be working with children to take the particular actions that we've got and said, how would you design this better from a child perspective? Water fountains, for example. We're going to have an action on water and a couple of actions on water. But this idea, let's get loads of water fountains, great idea, has been shown to work and so on. But actually, in situations of deprivation, what does that picture look like there? Let's actually engage with that and see what would the design of that water fountain look like. So that's a kind of human-centred design process. And I think you've done some similar things here in Scotland. And there's lots of interesting examples around that now. Now, the second point about policy design is around the system, and that's around incentivising a healthy food economy, which I haven't touched on much yet. But when you do analyses of tensions in the system that are preventing actions from happening, they're often for economic reasons. I emphasised before these issues of capacity capability about staff and head teachers and kids and dining halls being critically important, and that's part of it, really, really important. But the other part of the system that is so important is the economics of the system. And the current food system is driven by economics. This is just an example. Let's have sugary drinks taxes. Let's label sugary drinks. Let's have advertising bans on sugary drinks. Let's have bans on sugary drinks in schools. What is the soft drinks industry doing? It is restructuring. It is offsetting costs. It's making labour even cheaper and making people even poorer. It is upping their amount of marketing. And it's making sure that it's lobbying for competition law that permits mergers and acquisitions that makes them behave more economically efficient as a company. So it's offsetting any losses it might have had from all of those things that are reducing consumption of sugary drinks. But it's also doing some good things, if one believes them to be good. It's diversifying its core offer into low sugar drinks and water as well. It's not doing that everywhere in the world, though. It's still pushing out its full sugar drinks in many, many parts of the world. The point is that we're up against a big economic system when we're implementing any actions. So I think we need to work much, much harder to understand how business models actually work. And we did I did a piece of analysis that came out with the World Health Organization in 2017, trying to understand the incentives and disincentives of reducing sugar consumption in processed foods. And we found 10 incentives and disincentives. And we found that companies had 3 active incentives for reducing sugar in their foods, but 7 either disincentives or lack of incentives to reduce sugar. You can the report is freely available. And so that's just to show that the economics of those companies meant that they had more disincentives to keep sugar at current levels than they did have to reducing them. We need to better understand those incentives and disincentives. It's not just about, oh, they're evil companies, they want to make profit. There's more nuance going on there in the system. But we are seeing some examples of business models that are managing to thrive. And this morning when I was visiting there, I'm going to pronounce it wrong, the shop. The Ziggin Community Shop. I was asking about the business model, the business models are really, really important to think through about to think through the challenges, which are always very, very significant in shifting a business model from large companies producing or any company producing unhealthy foods to companies producing healthier foods, or incentivizing a whole economy which has healthy foods at their core. But there are some examples. This is an example, a well-evaluated example from the Alfred Health, which is a big, big hospital in Melbourne, in Australia. where they did a whole load of things around, like, removing drinks from display, for example. This is just from their drinks, but they did a whole load of things around increasing the healthy options on offer, moving things to the back of the store, changing their pricing. And they found that, and this example is just from the drinks, that they sold far fewer sugary drinks. But more importantly, from the point I'm trying to make today, is that there was no significant difference in drink sales overall. And in fact, with other foods offer, the economics was good. They got more business. So this is an example about, oh no, if I don't sell these, my business is going to go out of business. Actually, no, it carries on working. So there are these examples. Another example is from the Alexandra Rose vouchers, which are used in England for in markets, and that is good for those local markets. So that's an example about how you can match the economy of a local market with, in this case, financial support. So these are some relatively small-scale examples, but we need much, much more needed on the economics. We need the investor community to start saying to big companies, if you continue to sell this product portfolio, we're not going to invest in you. We need major policy changes that are really fundamental and about a new economics, which is a whole different conversation in a sense, but I think should be part of this conversation about obesity and unhealthy eating and ill health, where the economics of our system is just not favouring health. Final point then is about policy delivery, that we have to build system capacity and capability. It's no good just saying we've got this great action if we don't make sure that people are trained, that people are not supportive of it. All of these issues that I illustrated with the school meal example to enable coherence in that system. But we also need to create political commitment. We know from looking around the world that when there is political commitment, nutrition can improve and does improve, that with political will, change can happen, and we need to have this political commitment. So that's around policy delivery, around political commitment. You don't need to read that on the right. This is a paper that I wrote with an Australian colleague where we analysed factors that around political commitment to nutrition, and really found very, very clearly in the literature that political commitment can be created and should be seen as an action in and of itself. And in London, we're fortunate to have a strong political commitment of Mayor Sadiq Khan for his emphasis on obesity. And so that commitment is there from him. Also need to build commitment around all the London boroughs, which is a much more tricky affair. But I wanted to make this point about political commitment, about managing the media. I was talking to the mayor's health advisor last week on the phone about the plan. And, of course, the first thing he mentioned is, what's the media going to think? And it's omnipresent in our society, unfortunately, politicians worry a lot about the media. And we need to be thinking about that very carefully, even though it drives me absolutely mad. When communicating some of these issues. And my final point is that to create political commitment, one way of doing that is to experiment at the city level. I've become a big advocate of city level approaches. That's what I'll be talking about tomorrow at the Food Summit, where I think if politically it's very difficult nationally, if there are things to test and trial, there are lots of things that could be done, whether it's in Glasgow or in other cities in Scotland. And there are examples of this. Amsterdam is an example that I've particularly studied, the work that we're doing in London. Lots of other cities are getting on board with the healthy weight commitment in England. Juntos Santiago is a project I visited recently in Chile. So some really exciting work going on at the city level that, if it all seems too much, can be a good testing ground. So finally, to address obesity effectively and equitably, start with what we have. Let's remember we have a good base on which to build. This is not about starting from scratch. Connect more with people who experience the problem. Catalyse a healthier food economy and create coherence through systems capacity and commitment. They're the things that, if they are done together, remembering always that vision of what needs to really change from this perspective of a person's life, that's an aspiration that I have. And given it's a rather lofty aspiration, what keeps me going is the ability to learn and because we won't be there in my lifetime. But I think we can all carry on learning and be motivated by that. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Glasgow Centre for Population Health podcast. If you would like to find out more, search podcasts at gcph.co.uk.